You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Convert your current recessed lighting with energy-saving LED downlights from Fight Electric. They're bright and install easily in just minutes. They also go from regular lighting to nightlight mode with just a simple flip of a switch. Save big on all Fight lighting products now at Menards. Shop our lighting options today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Hey, it's Blake Smith, the host of Monster Talk. I'm hiding behind my couch right now, waiting to see if I can capture a photo of one of the most elusive cryptids of our time. It's the time of year when he's most likely to make an appearance. Of course, I mean, his existence is a big question. I mean, aside from the Gimli Peterson film in 1967, which shows a red, furry creature crossing a mall parking lot, there's really very little evidence for his actual existence except casts of his mysterious boot prints. I mean, some people say that film's fake. It's just a man in a suit. I don't know if it's true or not, but they say he comes every Christmas. I've put out bait. Got some cookies. Got my camera. And I'm waiting for Big Boot.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Okay, while I wait here for Big Boot, I'm going to put on an interview for you guys to listen to. It's with a guy named Christopher Dell, who's put together this incredible book called Monsters, a Bestiary of Devils, Demons, Vampires, Werewolves, and Other Magical Creatures. It's got beautiful artwork from around the world, and it just has all kinds of obscure monsters and talks about their place in human culture. I hope you enjoy it.
Monster Talk.
The preamble?
Well, I don't know. Just I need to get you to send me something about what you're doing these days, because I keep saying that you're a blogger, which is true, but you have a lot of new things going on.
You
know, you're a researcher and blogger and
president of a small country in
that
Asia.
Sort of thing. Right. And
I'll do that. For our Skeptic Society site.
And I need to remember to plug Ben's book when I do our closeout each time, because, I mean, until you sell out of them, I mean, right, you know.
Until then, yes.
So. I may do another sale too, Ben. I was talking with Joe, whose brother is credulous when it comes to ghosts, and so I recommended your book, and he's going to, because I'm in it.
Well, of course. No other reason.
Of course. No.
as is Blake, I should add.
I'm in it too. Yeah, I keep forgetting that, actually. That is totally true.
I was about to say that, but...
Yeah.
And Daniel, for that matter.
Well, and Daniel. That's right. And
but he's not here, so you don't need to suck up to him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good point. Good point. Because if you don't suck up to Daniel, he will... Oh, he'll bust your balls so bad. He's talking about assholes. This is a beautiful book, by the way, Ben.
Did you read it?
It's mostly pictures.
Just the kind he likes.
It is. I wish it was a pop-up book. But
pop-up, yeah.
Some of the pictures are very scary. And I love books like this. This is it's called Monsters, a Bestiary of Devils, Demons, Vampires, Werewolves, and Other Magical Creatures.
Oh, you said that correctly.
Which creatures?
Yeah.
This is by Christopher Dell. Bindi, what do you know about Christopher?
I know he lives in Spain.
Barcelona. I see that on the back here.
Mm-hmm. No, hold on. I'm not done yet.
Oh, okay. Wait, there's more.
I know he lives in Barcelona, Spain.
Barcelona.
He holds a degree in art history. And from an institute in London, and he is apparently into monster iconography and mythology.
Yeah, this is just
very
a
cool.
It's a very beautiful book. It's kind of like a coffee table, you know, chat book. Small chapters with lots of big, highly detailed pictures. Very,
perfect
very cool.
For you.
Oh, it is beautiful. I swear, this is the kind of book I would love to just have out on the table. Unfortunately, on the cover, it says devils and demons, which means that every time my mom and dad come over, I have to hide it or I'll scare them. And I don't want that to happen. So they're very uncomfortable. You know, they wouldn't let me play Dungeons and Dragons as a child because of the satanic panic.
I bet you did anyway.
I did not. I was a very good kid about following their instructions until I got into college. So I wouldn't play any role-playing game that had magic in it until I got into college.
The devil's work.
Right. So I would play science fiction role-playing games like Gamma World or as long as there was a science, basis for the explanation for the magical things, that was okay. That was totally true. She wouldn't let me watch Bewitched either. So here's what you get, folks. If you raise your kid really conservatively, you get a weird skeptic dude who wants to do monster shows. There you go. So I don't want to get off into a parenting tear, but my kids are going to be exposed to a lot more interesting things, I think. So
they'll become fundamentalist Christians.
I expect that. They'll both be pastors in their own church. I mean, I have three kids, but the girls, I think, are going to, surely.
Precious and precocious.
Yes, they are. So. Anyway, gorgeous book. So I'm really glad you sent this to me, Ben, to check out.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say, I thought it was kind of funny. Thank you. I don't know if you noticed this in the end of the book. It actually runs out of page numbers, which is kind of funny. Somewhere like 175. After page 175, there's no more page numbers. I'm not sure why.
Don't read those ones then.
Wait, nope. There's 180, 181, 182, 183. So on page 184, which doesn't appear to have a page number on it, is a picture. It's like an engraving or a woodcut showing a dinosaur attacking a French house. It looks very much something like a Godzilla or The Lost World. The Spielberg version, not the early Conan Doyle. Anyway, dinosaur peeking in the window, and I looked it up because this is probably one of the earliest pictures of a dinosaur in modern times I've seen depicted, and it's from Camille Flammarion's book Le Monde avant la création de la Homme. I guess I don't know how that's pronounced.
Beautiful French.
but it's
nothing like French with an American accent.
Yeah. Hey, y'all. Bonjour. Anyway, it says a prehistoric monster in a modern town. That's the name of the engraving from Camille Flammarion's book. And I thought that was funny because this was like the only picture that really looked completely new to me, like that I had never seen reproduced anywhere. Mm-hmm. Although I'm sure some of these may be.
You have like the Sleep of Reason produces monsters. You have some of the Goya stuff and some of the classic depictions of harpies, for example, and mermaids and Saint George and the Dragon and things like that. So
I was going to say Camille Flammarion. He wrote the book that reproduced the Lord Dufferin tale. That's where the tie-in was. I thought that's a funny. It's so even back then, even in the 1880s to 1920s, it's a small friggin' world of people who look into monsters and ghosts. So anyway,
I should point out that this book first came to my attention from a catalog from a publisher called Inner Traditions. And typically, to be honest with you, I'm not real impressed with Inner Traditions stuff. A lot of it is very new agey, woo-woo, this and that. So I was when I first saw the monsters, I thought it was going to be sort of a more ephemeral, less scientific or less I don't know, mythology based, but I was pleased to see that it was actually far more interesting, certainly to me, and in scientific in its approach and analysis.
And it does have the chapters themselves have nice little summaries of, you know, things like werewolves, demons, dragons. It's kind of funny because it kind of parallels the way we've done Monster Talk. There's hybrid monsters, water monsters, ghosts and ghouls, folklore monsters, how to fight monsters. And then it talks about the creatures that are on the, this is off the map. And it's got one of those famous pictures of the people with faces on their chests. Mm-hmm. And the kind of sort of little, sort of, they're not doodles exactly, but sort of things that would, folklore people, you know, people would say existed in foreign lands.
Sort of Middle Ages era stuff.
Yeah. And it's just.
This book's got everything.
It's real pretty.
It really, so we can does. Interview him, Chris, and end the show.
Yeah, and we'll be done. We'll have. It's funny because it's a really nice, if you'll pardon me for saying so, a bookend interview to the one we just did with the asthma interview in his book On Monsters. On Monsters is almost completely, you know, words. It's all words talking about the impact of monster in culture. And this Monsters book here is more of a picture book. It does have obviously some pros in it, but it's
pros
it's,
and cons.
It reminds
Rose means
me.
Something different in Australian English.
Does it really?
Yes.
What does it mean?
Take a guess.
It's an abbreviation.
Blake.
An abbreviation, yeah. For what? Professional?
What? Yeah. Close.
What is it? Prostitute?
Yes.
Is it really?
You don't use that here?
No.
Now you do.
Well, I mean, no. My wife won't let me.
Good one.
Well, I always assumed prostitute was a contraction of professional substitute. Is that not the case?
It's an interesting folkloric etymology.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
So what is the derivation, Karen?
No, not off the top of my head. I'll do an analysis if you like, but no, not off the top of my head.
Just curious.
Apparently it's
one of 4 million words.
It's one of the
English
world's
words.
Oldest professions.
And it's one of the Blake's I
had not. I had not heard that. It's composed of two Latin words, pro and statuary, which means to expose or to place up front.
Were you looking this up on American Heritage or something?
Wikipedia, which I just fascinating site. I don't know if anybody's heard of it before, but it's got several articles about various things. It's really cool. I'm going to update it so it says it's professional substitute. So. Now, here's an interesting word, pimp. I had not heard of that one either. Or madams.
So, monsters. A beast
monsters,
of
yes,
devils,
sorry.
Demons, vampires, werewolves, and other magical creatures. Well, why don't we see if we can get Christopher Dell on the line.
Monster Talk.
A quick note. We use Skype to record Monster Talk, which allows us to connect across the earth and talk for free to people all over the place. In today's episode, there's some clicking and wind sounds that we were not able to troubleshoot away during recording, nor engineer out during post. I apologize, but I think the audio here should be understandable, and so far the problem hasn't cropped up again. So, on with the show. So, we're going to talk today about your book's monsters.
Okay.
And while Ben just sent this to me in the mail, and it's just a gorgeous book.
Yeah, well, thanks.
Did it take a long time to put together?
Yeah, I reckon a couple of years, more or less. I mean, it's difficult. I mean, you've seen, obviously, the vast majority of it's pictures. I mean, I'm an art historian, and I'm interested in pictures. So I suppose there are things which I've sort of been picking up over the years or sort of finding away at the back of my mind. But in terms of kind of proper sort of picture research and research, yeah, a couple of years.
I'll start then. In your book, you cover a wide variety of monsters from around the world. So are monsters a universal concept?
Absolutely universal concept. I think for me, the most interesting thing about monsters is, especially from a visual point of view, is that they appear in every single culture throughout the whole of history. It's fascinating that the oldest surviving sculpture that we have is about 32,000 years old. It's a lion man found in a cave in Germany. And it's precisely that. The bottom half is human with a lion's head. It's a monster and it's 32,000 years old. Every single culture since then, we go through, say, Mesopotamian culture, we go through ancient Egypt, we're talking about 6,000 years ago, let's say, have the same things, the same blendings of animals and humans to create monsters. And then everything since then, in every single part of the world, we find the same thing.
Again, like Blake, I was looking through your book and I was just delighted to see all the fascinating images and pictures and stuff. How did you get involved in this? How did you get fascinated by the sort of monster iconography?
It's curious. I think the monster, that my kind of fascination with monsters really goes back to childhood. It must be the same with everyone. I was completely convinced for years and years and years that I had a Minotaur living in a cupboard in my bedroom.
A little bit of background noise. Are you using headphones or?
I am using headphones.
Okay. You don't have a window open or anything, do you?
Do you have to be jogging or on the wing of a plane?
Does that sound any better?
Yes.
Yeah, dramatic.
Yes.
Good. There we are.
Now, if you could just get rid of the accent. But other than that, it's great.
You too, then.
I like the accent. I think it makes our show sound more intellectual.
It definitely adds a touch of class.
That's right.
Well, let me just quickly follow up. Did you say that you used to believe that there was a Minotaur living under your bed? Was that right?
No. Where on earth did you get that from?
It was the bad audio, I think.
That was you, Ben.
Not in my bed. In my wardrobe.
Oh, well, that's completely different.
completely different. Completely different. I was convinced there was a Minotaur living in my wardrobe. For years and years. And in fact, bizarrely, I had the same dream about a Minotaur every night for about 3 years. That must have sort of sowed the seeds of fascination with monsters.
So what caused that thought?
Not a clue.
Medication or something?
Barry, wait, that is a funny Minotaur joke. because of the way he was defeated with a clue of thread.
Stretch. It was good, wasn't it?
Yeah. He's witty.
It's planned.
Fantastic. Our audience will totally get that.
Now they will. You've explained it.
Yeah, well. So, how did you pick what kind of art you wanted to put in? I mean, goodness gracious, you covered just about every kind of art. You went from the Stone Age all the way through the Renaissance to the Baroque to modern times. Just a fabulous assortment of, you know, monstrous depictions. How did you decide what was going to stay and what was going to go?
More than anything else, visual effect. I say in the introduction to the book that monsters, first and foremost, are visual beings. It's interesting. Whenever we read about monsters, whenever they appear in stories, it's always their visual aspect which matters most. It's always how sharp the teeth are, or how many tails or heads or whatever they've got, how spiky they are, how furry they are. I suppose they're the kind of anecdotal things which are very easy to add to when you're telling a story. When you're retelling a story, you can exaggerate things, you can emphasize things. They're fundamentally visual things, and therefore, to a large extent, it was on the basis of visually sensational things. What we have to remember, of course, is that every single image in this book is the work of man. It's the work of bizarre, fevered imaginations, but the work of man, and I really wanted that to come through. I wanted the reader to see the human imagination, the power of the human imagination in all its twisted glory, I suppose.
Well put.
And so you were speaking about a creature you used to believe in. Do you believe in any of the monsters that you depict in the book nowadays?
No. I'm about as atheistic as one can be, I suppose is the best way of putting it. And in this sense, there's a subtext, and it's probably rather feeble subtext, but there's a subtext nonetheless to the book that nobody in the entire history of the world, nobody in any of these cultures, in any of these countries, has ever seen a monster. Doesn't stop us believing in them, doesn't stop us creating them, but the fact is nobody has ever seen one. And some people, I suppose, would draw parallels with God. and perhaps I would be one of them. But I do think it's absolutely fascinating, the fact that even though there's no evidence for any of these things anywhere, we don't find any interesting monster skeletons anywhere, nor bits of monster fossil or anything, that we carry on believing in them. We carry on.
But
unfortunately, I think a lot of... Sorry. I think a lot of people do believe they have evidence and do believe they've experienced sightings.
Well, only in the same way that people believe they've experienced... they've experienced sightings of ghosts, let's say, to take another example. The simple fact is, if ghosts existed the same as monsters, the world would be teeming with ghosts and monsters. You yourself would have seen a ghost, or if not many, many, many ghosts, and we would have all seen many, many monsters. In the same way that we've all seen a cat, we've all seen a cockroach, we've all seen a koala. we would quite simply all have seen monsters. It's as simple as that. Which sort of takes me on to... I mean, what's interesting about monsters, of course, is they exist and they have to exist beyond our everyday world. They have to exist in a supernatural realm or in a place where we're not. And, of course, I mean, that takes us all the way back to, sorry, just to jump around a little bit, but takes us to, say, Pliny, for example. It takes us back to the classical geographers, who weren't really geographers in the conventional sense at all, but who were interested in faraway lands. And I suppose a little bit like, I just as I want to do with my book, I want to sort of, I want to thrill the reader a little bit, kind of visually. Well, Pliny was doing the same thing. He wanted to thrill his reader with tales of bizarre creatures in faraway lands like Ethiopia and India, where you have people with heads in their bodies, or you have dog-headed men, obviously the famous ones.
Well, let me ask you about that. I mean, what role does culture play in the perception of monsters? I mean, for example, how are Asian monsters different from European ones and American ones?
In many respects, they're not different at all. One of the things I found most shocking about this book in relation to Asian monsters, I mean, first of all, let me say Asian monsters are the best monsters anywhere. Asian monsters are amazing. And the further east you go until you get to Japan, they get more and more interesting. And obviously, Japan is the world capital of monsters as far as I'm concerned. They have so many and they're so very, very, very strange. But Asian monsters, and we're talking often about fundamentally Buddhist traditions, are absolutely teeming with demons, and Buddhism these days isn't associated with demons. We're happy with medieval demons, we're happy with the kind of the traditional Christian punishment going to hell sort of demons, but in many, many Buddhist traditions you'll find these demons too, and they're astonishing things. They're really, really quite evil-looking things. Did that answer your question? Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, that's just one thing that I find fascinating is, you know, when you examine monster traditions from around the world, you know, how each culture sort of adapts, you know, sort of larger archetypes into their more localized variants.
No, I mean, I was going to say, just sort of thinking back to your original question, I mean, what, and the classic example, obviously, is dragons. Dragons, which are things fundamentally which come from, as far as we can tell, really come from Mesopotamia. And they're coming from the sort of Babylon region. They're coming 6,000 years ago, more or less. We find them sort of very soon after, produced these wonderful terracotta panels that we find in that sort of part of modern-day Iran, Iraq mostly. And then they spread to Egypt. They then start appearing in the Bible. We get Leviathans and things like this. And then, of course, they turn into sort of serpent-like strange things, which then appear in Greek mythology. Dragons then go on after the Greeks, and after the Greeks really established the tradition of the hero killing the dragon. So dragon then becomes a symbol of chaos, fundamentally, and the hero is restoring order. Then we have the whole sort of heroic tradition going into Norse mythology, going into the sort of whole of European mythology. Because meanwhile, the dragon is heading east as well. And the dragon heads east, and we find it in later Persian miniatures, for example, amazing things, beautiful colored dragons. And of course, they go to China and Japan, where they become radically different things, because dragons fundamentally are, they're lucky creatures. they're often benign creatures. They're creatures that can help. They can cause an awful lot of problems as well. But fundamentally, they're a very positive thing. To be born in the year of the dragon, as was I, is a good thing.
Me too.
Oh, good. There we are. I think it's next year.
I just was going to quick follow up on that. It's fascinating you're talking about that, because I remember when I used to play Dungeons & Dragons, one of the main things I remember from the Monster Manual was that there were, as I recall, at least a dozen different types of dragons. It wasn't just one dragon. There were like red dragons and silver dragons, and each of them had their own distinct characteristics and abilities and powers and personalities. And it's interesting that what you're saying reflects that.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
I mean, fundamentally, dragons are, I suppose, serpents. They're serpents, and then we've sort of welded little bits onto them. There's an interesting story, which I very briefly recount in the book, and the Chinese tradition of the Yellow Emperor, whose emblem was a serpent. And as he went around conquering other tribes, he would then incorporate parts of their emblem, sort of tacking them on, welding them on to his serpent to eventually end up with the dragon, which is a rather fun story behind the dragon. But in a sense, there's an element of truth there, that snakes, of course, are universally feared. Snakes appear, apart from the Bible, obviously, going all the way back to original sin and the serpent in the tree, that snakes are invariably cause problems throughout mythology, throughout various mythological traditions around the world, and therefore it's natural, I suppose, to the dragon is the development of the snake.
Speaking of the Bible and religion, I know the history of monsters in what we have as recorded history goes back a long way. We had sort of these hybrid creatures that the Egyptians worshipped as gods, with animal heads, human bodies. And then you have things like Enkidu in the story of Gilgamesh, sort of a wild beast man. There's that delineation between the folkloric monster, the religious monster. How do you think these differ? They're all monstrous, but in your studies, your research here for your art, what did you find the big differences between religious monsters and non-religious monsters to be?
It's interesting to answer that slightly obliquely. In fact, one of the things I found about religious monsters is that, and I suppose now and then I'm specifically talking about Christianity, is that religious monsters, and they tend to be devils and demons and things like that, the church only wants to be scary. But in fact, there's very little orthodoxy. There isn't really an orthodox representation, for example, of the devil, let's say. I mean, he's the kind of classic archetypal monster. They don't really care what the devil looks like. The Bible certainly doesn't give a description of the devil. And in fact, none of the Apocrypha really give a description of the devil either. So the devil then is thrown into the hands of the artists, and the artists do whatever they want with it. But the main object of the exercise is to terrify the faithful. Angels, on the other hand, interestingly, do have very orthodox depictions that artists have to stick to a particular template. So that sort of partly answers your question. But I would say, I'm just trying to think, sort of religious...
Yeah, you know, I was going to say the angels, the depictions we usually see, though, aren't the way they're described in the Bible for the most part. I mean, I guess the modern depiction of the angel as sort of humanoid figure, angelic-looking even, that has become an adjective now. Whether, you know, perhaps the cherubs are right, but, you know, a lot of the angels have multiple eyes, multiple wings, you know, just very scary creatures.
And the multiple wings is in the Bible.
Right, right. They're very frightening, but you don't, you know, most people see angels now and we see these sort of little cherubic or, you know, humanoid. They're very, very human looking. And I don't, that doesn't seem particularly biblically sound.
Well, I mean, it at least corresponds with various apocryphal texts. This is the thing. I mean, I suppose my point there is that the church wants angels to look a particular way, but they don't care how devils look so long as they frighten people. One thing that is very, very interesting about Christianity, obviously, is there are very, very few monsters. I mean, in fact, all of the great monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, none of them really have monsters in the way that we would understand it. I kind of very briefly cover, I mean, you have the golem, obviously, in Judaism, but this is very much a later thing. Related to earlier texts, but in the kind of monster form that we have of it is a much later thing. Islam, you have a whole history, a whole tradition of jinns. You have a tradition of devils and demons, but fundamentally they don't feature very heavily in the Quran at all. And of course, the Bible is actually very, very short on monsters. We have Leviathan, we have Behemoth, we have hints at other things, but very, very little that's concrete. And I don't know why. I suppose because apart from the devil, and of course, the devil is a very abstract concept. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, at least, they don't want to create other beings that might have some sort of power that would rival the power of the Creator. And again, monsters are supernatural creatures. They're not things that can exist in day-to-day life. That is their point.
And so what would you say that the existence of monsters, if only as folklore, says about humankind?
It says more than anything else that we love telling stories and that we love embellishing these stories. Right now, in fact, I'm sort of working on something else which looks at mythology more broadly, and it is astonishing, the stories that you read and the way that then they're reinterpreted and the way that they evolve over the centuries on the millennia. Monsters are exactly the same. We find the same monsters in lots of different cultures, lots of different times, but often with similar traits which then have evolved. I mean, vampires, for example, is a classic example of a monster which evolves over time, which obviously goes back to the symbolism of blood, which is particularly loaded, but then to which we add layer upon layer of symbolism until we end up with a rather sort of complex thing that we have today.
As the three of us know, and you as well, all of us being monster aficionados, many of the monsters that we see are human hybrids. You know, you have the Minotaur, mermaids, harpies. What do you think it is that people find so fascinating about human yet not human creatures?
I think the most interesting thing about them by far is the fact that they are very close to us and yet they are distant from us. You look at something like the Minotaur, for example, and it's so frustrating because in Greek mythology, of course, we get the point of view of Theseus, we get the point of view of everyone around the central figure, the Minotaur himself, but we don't have the Minotaur's point of view. We don't know whether he's thinking. We don't know whether he could talk. We don't know what he felt about everything that was going on around him. And in a sense, that's what's so unsettling about these hybrids, these things which are close to us. For example, you get a cow's head and you put it on a human's body and you have to ask yourself, well, is it thinking? Does it have a human capacity for thought? Or is it still fundamentally a cow's brain in there or a bull's brain in there? This unnerves us deeply because we don't know how to react to it. We don't know whether the eyes are bull's eyes or human's eyes anymore. It's that juxtaposition which throws everything. It turns our world upside down completely. So yes, it's the closeness and the distance at the same time which bothers us.
In your research here, what were some of your favorite or most interesting monsters that you got to include in the book?
I mean, my favorite monsters have always been Japanese monsters because there's an endless inventiveness there. They're so good at just inventing monsters almost for every eventuality, I suppose, is a way of putting it. I mean, you get these amazing things which, for example, come out at night, these various sprites, and clean your bathroom or lick your bathroom clean. And I became very, very attracted to the Japanese monster tradition, not least because it is very, very fluid, because particularly, in fact, in the 18th and 19th centuries, people are adding to it and subtracting to it and suddenly creating new things, this amazing burst of energy, but also because it's a very visually driven thing. And I'd say of all of the Japanese monsters, my favorite is probably the kappa. And I think there are a couple of pages on it in the book. And it's a strange, strange creature. Which is fundamentally, I suppose, it's half human, half frog. I mean, it has a definite sort of amphibious look about it. It lives in ponds, mostly, sort of small lakes. And by and large, it waits for people to, small children to go in the water. It grabs and drags them to the bottom and feeds on them, of course. To the extent even today in Japan, you will actually find signs telling people to beware of the kappas around sort of small pools of water. It also does all sorts of slightly less pleasant things. There's a wonderful Hokusai illustration from the 19th century of a man, for want of a better word, defecating into a river. With a kappa waiting underneath. And in fact, the kappa's favorite pastime was when people were about to defecate into rivers to jump up and to suck their organs out through their anuses. And this is, yes, exactly.
I see a horror film in this.
and it's just such a perverse pleasure, isn't it? It's such a perverse sort of delicacy and the way that they would wait. The other wonderful, wonderful thing about the kappa, of course, is it has this sort of indentation in the top of its head, which it has to keep water in. So when it goes out of its natural element, when it goes out of water, it has to keep the water sort of balanced on top of its head all the time. Otherwise it dies, and therefore you get all these sort of wonderful Japanese hero tales of people, for example, killing kappas. By taking advantage, more than anything else, of their unfailing politeness. Because when you bow to a kappa, they're obliged to bow back, the water falls out, and they die.
That is classic.
It's Japanese.
Yeah.
Absolutely, so Japanese. And of course, all the best monsters say something about the cultures that spawn them. No, there's no question about that. But the Japanese monsters are the best.
But you know... I thought it was also very funny that the kappa has a weakness for cucumbers.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, the kappa is a classic example of a monster that, for whatever reason, people warm to. And therefore, it's like a micro industry kind of springs up around this one thing. We find exactly the same thing with werewolves and exactly the same thing with vampires, of kind of embellishing the myth. Of adding things. And people love this. And the monsters, that's an integral part. The storytelling is such an integral part of all of these monsters.
I don't think we'd have anything comparable in the Western world, would we?
No, I mean, obviously we do have, you know, for example, werewolf myths and things like that, but it's more sinister. It's more...
Well, you have naiads and, you know, they would be kind of a comparable river spirit.
Not as honourable, though.
They're not as honourable, and they're not as much fun. I mean, that's what's interesting.
No, definitely not as much fun.
The Japanese monsters are often terribly, terribly good fun. And this is something which has developed over hundreds and hundreds of years, that they've been sort of embellished and embellished and embellished. And I also think that the Japanese take monsters far more seriously, in a funny sort of way, that they really enjoy the monster stories. And somehow a lot of them just aren't as sinister, even though they want to suck your organs out of them.
And you didn't really get into the gigantic kaiju, the giant Japanese monsters, like Godzilla and Anguirus and those guys. But that's what my son is into right now. So, you know, it's not just their folklore monsters, even their new monsters that they're, you know, doing through cinema. Well, and if you think about it, the whole wave of J horror films, the Japanese horror films like The Grudge and The Ring, you know, that. I don't think it's just because they're not westernized. You know, they really are making some marvelous, fantastic contributions to horror and monster lore. So I'm in agreement with you.
Yeah, and I think I mean, it's interesting. I didn't. I think I may have mentioned Godzilla in passing. And I mean, I love all this stuff, but the fact is, by and large, I shied away from the 20th century and I shied away from cinema. More than anything, because I wanted to show that there was life in monsters before. And also that a lot of the things that we have been so shocking, I suppose, in cinema in the past, say, 50 years, in fact, were already in existence perhaps 500 years ago. That there's very little which anyone's come up with in a horror film that can really match something produced by, say, Lucas Cranach or Hieronymus Bosch, working perhaps in the 15th or 16th centuries in the Netherlands. But, well, there's nothing new under the sun.
I actually hadn't heard of the rather creative attacks on the defecating people in the streams. I'm quite intrigued by that. It actually reminds me of some stories that I'd heard about the water horses, for example, in Scotland and in the Highlands, that were said to not only try and drown people, sort of luring them into the water, but often would sometimes chase down young women and apparently rape them. Are there any other creative monster attacks on humans that are especially memorable to you?
Yeah, well, I mean, today you're talking about kelpies. The Kelpies in Scotland, which one of my great regrets. Sorry, I desperately wanted to include them. I just couldn't find an image that was exciting enough, which I was very angry about, because they're fascinating things. Really, really quite unpleasant creatures who, very much like the Kappas, however, love dragging people to their deaths. There isn't any one monster in particular. I suppose one category of monsters that is interesting are the sirens. It's been, in fact, the past couple of weeks I've been doing a lot of interviews here in Spain, and one question they always ask me is, but why have you included sirens, or sirenas, as they call them, in the book? Because aren't these kind of lovely creatures? And it's interesting because in Latin languages, they find it far more difficult to distinguish between mermaids and sirens. Mm-hmm. And of course, in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, we're very happy making the distinction. The mermaid is fundamentally a fairly positive thing who often helps lost sailors, etc., hence the little mermaid. And sirens are very, very nasty creatures who originate with Odysseus, obviously, sort of semi-bird-like, perhaps semi-aquatic, swooping women who sing to lure sailors to their deaths on the rocks.
Yeah, so, I was going to say, Ben's actually produced a cartoon short about sirens that I think does a nice job of highlighting their nastiness.
Well, really? That I'd love to see. I love the sirens in the sense that they sort of want to destroy mankind by producing this amazing, irresistible, beautiful music, which is such a wonderful juxtaposition.
You said kappas are still widely believed in today, and we've talked on previous episodes about folklore, cultural beliefs, and house spirits, and that sort of thing, where people leave out offerings. sometimes for religious reasons, sometimes just for superstitious reasons. But what kind of monsters that you've researched here did you notice are still widely accepted as probably being real by?
I think that there is an ongoing fascination, if not obsession, with vampires. And it does seem that at least half the teen population of the world at the moment deeply wants vampires to be real, even if they're not completely. That, I suppose, is really caught up with the 19th century sort of romance horror, where suddenly all of these things become terribly glamorous, even sexy, I suppose, for want of a better word. Vampires, in particular, however, become really quite desirable things. They're the most curious sort of monster because they obviously have their origins fundamentally in tales of Vlad the Impaler, whose favourite pastime back in the Middle Ages was to impale his enemies on spikes, and often in their hundreds, which has obviously combined with other sort of blood-sucking monster myths and other metamorphosis myths to we end up in the 19th century with this rather sort of svelte, suave vampire, and which in recent years throughout the 20th century has just hung on and hung on and hung on. And I really do think that an awful lot of people probably do believe in vampires these days, or as I say, deeply want to believe in vampires. Werewolves, too, have really been kept alive by film, and of course glamorized by film an awful lot. And again, I'm sure there are thousands of people out there who would love to be able to turn into wolves, if nothing else. I suppose, in a funny sort of way, just as perhaps back in the 16th century, the monsters that are easiest to believe in are sea monsters, for the simple fact that it's very, very difficult to prove that they're not there. Hence the enduring obsession in the British Isles, at least, with Nessie, let's say, the Loch Ness Monster. It's a classic example. But in fact, most large lakes around the world have lake monsters. And these are things which are very, very widely believed in still. I wouldn't say the majority of the population, but people, again, really want to believe. For years and years, I desperately wanted to believe that there was something in Loch Ness. It is very, very deep. There could be anything down there. Who knows? Perhaps it is a dinosaur that survived somehow. Unlikely, but people want.
You reminded me of something else earlier. You talked about Hieronymus Bosch. And my only exposure to Bosch's work is through The Garden of Earthly Delights. Did he make any other horrific artwork? I mean, because that is such a great piece with so much detail in it. It's very, very disturbing.
It's incredibly disturbing. There's a detail of it in the work in the book. You have to remember that in the 15th, 16th centuries, there was vast demand for this sort of image, not necessarily as weird as the works that Bosch produced, but certainly as barbaric in many cases, that evil and evil people had to be represented in a suitably horrific way. And of course, Bosch produced dozens and dozens and dozens of paintings, many of which revive or include similar demons from the 12th century onwards. In the West, for example, the images of the Last Judgment become a real staple of art. And the Last Judgment, of course, is always split into two parts. There are the good, the elect, who are going to go to heaven, and they're escorted by angels. And there's the other half, the damned, who are funneled off to hell. The mouth of hell is normally horrific. It's a huge gaping maw in most cases. And Bosch certainly did plenty of that. And then, of course, there are dozens and dozens of demons normally already torturing people on their way down. So I think Bosch really was, while a pioneer and a bit of a visionary and perhaps a little bit mad as well, certainly out on a limb, was working within a kind of well-established tradition of deliberately horrific imagery.
And we were talking about hybrid monsters earlier. Are there any monster feature combinations that we don't really see? I guess there'll be lots of them.
That's a brilliant question. One thing I've never seen, but I did look for, was a sort of human spider. I mean, obviously we have Spider-Man, but that's a completely different thing. There are certain combinations that you would love to see, certainly. And I've never found anything to... sort of humans and insects, you don't see combined a huge amount at all. There is one very, very strange image in the book, which looks a little bit like maybe a cricket or a grasshopper with something like a cat's head. Needless to say, it's Japanese again, in the 17th century this time. Which is really, really bizarre. But that I was a little bit disappointed about. I would hope to find more sort of insect-slash-human combinations, which, of course, then you get... I mean, you get the transformation in the fly, obviously, I mean, the Kafka story and maybe the film. But earlier, you don't get much of that. And I wonder whether that's anything to do with microscopes.
Hmm. Yeah, there was that issue of scale, I suppose.
Yeah, I do think it's that, and it's interesting because I suspect a lot of these medieval artists, for example, had access to better optics, they would have produced even more bizarre and horrific things.
Do you happen to know anything about the Beast of Gavidon in France?
Yeah, I cover it briefly in the book. It's a fascinating example of mass hysteria. What's interesting about monsters, especially in these instances where there's a sighting, or perhaps normally it's a mauled cow or something like that, something being ripped to shreds in some unlikely way, people become absolutely hysterical. That was precisely what happened in France in the mid to late 18th century. There were all sorts of sightings of huge wolves, or perhaps even larger, like a wolf bear sort of creature, definitely demonic in some way. People, while they fear these things, it's a completely natural fear, especially back in the 18th century, they also really, really want them to be true. And you see this time and time again with these monster scares, that people somehow love the frenzy, they love the hysteria, they want it all to be real. I think this goes back to the idea of breaking through the natural world into the supernatural, looking for signs of there being something beyond the day-to-day. So really, yeah, the whole incident in Gavidon was mass hysteria. And of course, eventually the king's soldiers were sent down because there was such hysteria. They caught something, or perhaps they didn't catch anything, depending on which account you believe. And they then paraded what was probably quite a large wolf, but nothing else. there was a very interesting film made on it.
The Brother of the Hood of the Wolf.
Let me see. It must have come out about 3-4 years ago. Was that it?
Yeah, it was French. It was a French film. Sort of a. Actually, it was interesting. Yeah, it had a martial arts kind of take on it. Yeah, but
yeah.
But yeah, beautiful film. And I guess in that version, I don't want to spoil it for the audience because somebody might not have seen it. It is well worth the rental.
Yeah. Very cool film.
It's a good. It's almost like a French buddy cop movie from the 1700s.
Exactly. There we are. Beautifully put. They'll put that on the DVD case.
Yeah. It's quite a fun movie. It's interesting that particular story is. Because the historical record has, an account of hundreds of deaths, lots and lots of people assume that they're all true. And I unfortunately don't have enough skill with French to go back and look at the primary sources myself. But, people have speculated all sorts of things. But I like your sort of parsimonious take on it. I think that's probably more likely to be the case.
we do keep going back to the fundamental problem that we just don't find very many monster skeletons. And if monsters exist and if they procreate in the same way as us, then they would have families, and every now and again they would die. And then we would find something. And this gnaws away at me. I suppose I'm the same as everybody else. I want them to exist. But you know what? If they did exist, they would just be another physical creature, the same as you and I. And therefore not even remotely interesting. And it's the fact that they can't exist, the fact that there is could be something out there which completely turns the laws of nature on its head, that's what's appealing.
It looked like you left out clowns, which is one of the most terrifying monsters. Was that because you were scared of them? Or
I'm scared of nothing. But it is interesting working on this book. But I mean, there's no doubt that I suppose my journey from belief, albeit rather watered down, but the sort of belief that I suppose many of us kind of keep because it's difficult to shake off, to total and utter scepticism, to total and utter atheism, for want of a better word. I don't know if you're allowed to say that in the States anymore.
In two-thirds of it, you can say it.
Okay, fine. My journey has been one of gradually losing fear. Because obviously monsters are a reflection of fear or a motivation for fear. To the point where I've come to the conclusion that a genuine atheist, a genuine skeptic, is somebody who can walk through a forest, a darkened forest, in the middle of the night without batting an eyelid, which I can just about do now in a funny sort of way. And the forests around here, I mean, there are a few wild boar, which potentially could give you problems, but hopefully not at night. But apart from that, there's nothing. There are no
players. As monsters go, boars are boring, so there you go.
It's very, very boring indeed, unless you could lop its head off and put it on a human's body, in which case it would be a bit more interesting.
That's true.
But, but it's as simple as that. And in a sense, by looking at so many images of monsters, I've become not quite desensitized to them, because I still find them fascinating, I still find them desperately appealing, but I suppose I've almost realised the kind of folly of the whole thing.
And Chris, do you have any upcoming books or projects that you'd like to tell us about?
I'm currently working on the next. I have got another book coming out at exactly the same time, back in the house already, which is a very conventional art history book. Although it did allow me to work with Philip Pullman, who's one of my heroes.
And
I've shared some very interesting conversations with him on the subject of monsters. He's an absolutely fascinating man. Sorry, that's to go off on a tangent. That's a book called What Makes a Masterpiece, which is about very conventional forms of art history. But in fact, I'm sort of actually spiraling off in the opposite direction at the moment towards less conventional forms of art history. Monsters, in many respects, is it's a look at a different visual culture. It's the sort of visual culture that some of these works absolutely hang in very famous galleries around the world, but many of them don't. And I'm very interested in alternate forms of visual culture. So, in fact, my next book, which I'm just working on at the moment, is on broader mythologies and depictions of mythologies, again, around the world. Needless to say, monsters feature fairly heavily, but it's fascinating to broaden it out a little bit.
Well, it's certainly an excellent book, and again, I appreciate all the research and work that you put into it. It's a fine book, and I just sit here for half an hour sipping some tea and just flipping through all the amazing images that you collected there.
Well, thank you. That's really kind. I mean, I love it. Often when you finish a project, you know what it's like. You don't want to pick it up. You don't want to look at it. And this is a book which I keep going back to. I love flicking through it because it is a testament to human imagination. Every single work in this book has been dreamt up and executed by a human. This is what's so important. And that instead of bemoaning the fact that the supernatural, apparently at least, doesn't exist, and that we aren't able to contact it, we should really be celebrating the fact that we've got it inside us, that we don't have to go any further, that we're able to dream up all of these things and depict them for ourselves.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time talking with us today.
Not at all. It's been an absolute pleasure. It's been a real pleasure.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Monster Talk. Our show is produced with the help of Skeptic Magazine. Your hosts were myself, Blake Smith, Dr. Karen Stolzno, and Ben Radford. Today, we interviewed Christopher Dell about his book Monsters, a bestiary of devils, demons, vampires, werewolves, and other magical creatures. A link to the book's in the show notes at monstertalk.org. Hey, if you like Monster Talk, or if you hate it,
why not come share your opinion on our message boards? You can also join our fan page on Facebook. And you can find our individual Twitter and Facebook info, as well as our biographies. All that's at monstertalk.org and skeptic.com. Music for today's episode was by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Shh. I think I hear something coming down my chimney right now. Oh, it is. Okay, the lights are off, but I definitely see a tiny man in what looks to be a reddish suit. Ooh, with enormous boots. How did he fit down my chimney? I'm going to turn on the lights.
James, Randy.
And now it's time for a visit from the Magic Cloud, and here he is.
For more skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
No. I mean, do whatever you want. Edit it to say, I am the devil himself. Worship me.
Leave that in.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.